This is the Capital City Recap with Michael Cohen on More Compelling Talk Radio, 1320 WILS.
1320 WILS. It is Wednesday, back from the 4th of July holiday. Later in the half hour, you will find out just how much sex seniors are having, even in nursing homes. It's shocking. Let's begin with the weather. 86 right now, getting to a low of 64. It's been very hot today. Not very much changes tomorrow. Thursday, high of 91, a low of 69. It is going to be very hot. And then Friday, thunderstorms, a high of 86 on Friday. We're all watching the ongoing battle between President Trump and the news networks. The latest one, a tweet regarding CNN. I'm sure you've seen that one. My next guest knows exactly how the industry works. Cheryl Atkinson is with us. She is a former investigative correspondent for CBS News. She was a substitute anchor on the CBS Evening News. She did resign from CBS and then wrote a New York Times best-selling book, Stonewalled. Her brand new book, though, is The Smear: How Shady Political Operatives and Fake News Control What You See, What You Think, and How You Vote. Cheryl, great to have you on WILS.
Thank you, and I hope you don't mind me mentioning I host Sinclair's Sunday morning news program now across the nation called Full Measure with Cheryl Atkinson, where I do a lot of what I used to do on CBS.
Yeah, Sinclair. Now, they're buying up quite a few TV stations right now.
There's a pending purchase of a group called Tribune, and that would put us, I think we feed to 43 million households now, but that would maybe double or more our household and reach, is from what I understand.
Yeah. Now, what does that do with Sinclair? Is there a certain philosophy on news at a place like Sinclair?
The general philosophy is accountability reporting and holding powers accountable. The owner is a conservative figure, much as the owners or those pulling the strings at CBS when I was there were Democrat donors and Democrat supporters. Mm-hmm. But most of the time at CBS, that didn't trickle down to us. And at Sinclair so far, that has not trickled down to my program. And I don't think it will, because that was part of the conditions of being willing to do the program there.
Now, and you left CBS in 2014. What led to that decision?
A huge sea change in the industry that's been, many years in the making, but I saw it culminating about that time, whereby I think political and special interests and corporate interests mm-hmm. have gotten their nose under the tent in the newsrooms in such a way that they influence what we do and don't report.
Like, give me an example of just how they influence that process.
Transactional journalism, it's a chapter in the book that reveals emails showing reporters colluding inappropriately, in my view, with those they report on to use certain words to report a certain thing, a certain way, to run their stories by their political figures before they're published, which is wholly inappropriate, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, huge organizations like David Brock's groups of nonprofits, Media Matters, LLCs, websites, charity groups, all with political motivations, they train and know how to get inside newsrooms with their pundits to appear on TV and sometimes get hired in the newsrooms as reporters, anchors, and editorial managers. So that's another way. There are many different ways, and I just think there are so many that it became almost inextricable. Like the relationship between news people and those we report on were getting very, very intertwined.
Okay. And you're saying that you felt that was not the case when you first came to CBS News?
Well, there's always, been influences of every sort on news. I'm sure I'm not the first to think it or discover it. But it got to a point for me, only the last 2 years or so at CBS with certain personalities and editorial positions, and I certainly wasn't the only one complaining of this, mm-hmm. where I couldn't do what I thought was my job, honest reporting. And the way I like to explain it, how a producer explained it to me at CBS in my last book, they say that you go out to a story, they say, go report that the car is red, let's say you're from New York. You get to the scene and you see the car is blue, call and tell them, and they say, well, that's well and good, but Associated Press, I'm reading the wires, they say the car is red, and you say, mm-hmm. but I'm looking at the car and it's blue, and they say, fine, but make it red.
Okay.
And they were writing their own little novelettes and literally saying, go find an interview to say X, putting words in their mouth. And if you get to the scene and say, but that's not factually true or what's happening, some of them just didn't want to hear that.
Okay, which means what happened? I mean, did you see reporters try to buck that system in any way? Or?
All the time, every day, those last couple of years. I mean, it's not just me. I probably was the least of it in terms of I was not a daily news reporter. I was did more stories maybe once or twice a week. Mm-hmm. But there are reporters that every day tried to do what they had been doing for years and bring facts to light and tell the New York managers what was going on, and were being rebuffed and shaped and, narratives being cultivated in and out of their stories. And that wasn't just happening at CBS.
And talking to Cheryl Atkinson, the brand new book is The Smear. And you talk about fake news. When Donald Trump says mainstream media like CNN, MSNBC, and so on, that is fake news. Do you agree with him?
Well, I don't know. I see different sides of that. I say in the book, fake news is in the eye of the beholder. Conservatives tend to define it as, mainstream liberal news that's mistaken or wrong. Liberals tend to define it as conservative news that's either fake or wrong. Mm-hmm. I think there are many examples. You look back to the National Enquirer and the supermarket rags. Back in the old days, it wasn't called fake news, but, aliens stealing babies and things like that. I kind of trace that history. Mm-hmm. And I look at where the use of the phrase fake news came from, when it emerged quite suddenly on the narrative landscape, who was trying to use it to their advantage, and how Donald Trump ended up co-opting it. People now think, a lot of people think he thought of it. Mm-hmm. But actually, it was a liberal invention around September of 2016 by a nonprofit group, as far as I can tell, that turned out to be funded by Google, largely, whose parent company, Alphabet, was the head of that was number two donor to Hillary Clinton. It's sort of a long tail, but you can kind of see the emergence of fake news as a narrative, not that it doesn't exist, but how it was used to try to control opinions and thought toward the end of the 2016 election campaign.
So what do you think about how it's being used now and how mainstream media is being called fake news then?
Well, I just find it, instructive to watch. And I write about this, how the things that have been tried against Donald Trump, I call him the anti-smear candidate, because the same things that would stick to somebody else don't stick to him in the same way, because he doesn't behave the same way. And being the master marketer or brander that he is, once fake news started being used, instead of, whoever it was being used against kind of folding and capitulating, Donald Trump stole the phrase.
Although he seems to be, it seems like he's being essentially, attacked, some would say smeared by mainstream media nightly, especially by, outlets like CNN. How is he avoiding, what do you think the impact of that really is on him then?
Well, I'm not saying it doesn't have an impact, but what I observed during the campaign was he still got elected. And I think there were more forces fighting him at once than anybody. A lot of people compare him to Reagan, but I say, first of all, I was born, but I wasn't watching politics during Reagan. But I've had people who work for him say, well, he was treated the same way. Mm-hmm. I said, but there was no internet and social media, and I think that's been a game changer. Maybe this would have happened to other presidents had all the same factors been in play. But Donald Trump has had to fight not only the media, not only Democrats, but members of his own party, as we know, who don't like him being there. And the smear industry, as I call it, has never been more sophisticated or well-funded. It's grown up in Washington, D.C., under the radar in many respects. And they have social media and the internet at their disposal on top of
now,
it.
Cheryl Atkinson with us here on WILS. Her brand new book is called The Smear. Now, when you talk about the smear industry, is it equal on both sides of the political divide?
I argue that both sides would like to be as good at it, and over time, some have thought that conservatives have the edge, and some have thought at different times liberals have the edge, and I have examples of both. But going into the 2016 election, both liberal and conservative smear artists that I interviewed for the book thought that liberals had the edge in terms of organization and messaging, and I tend to agree with that based on my research. Mm-hmm. Although, interestingly, as we see how it ended up, they didn't win the White House, so with all the money and the messaging they had, we kind of trace how all of that was deployed and yet how Trump somehow managed to defy the machine that had been put in place really after decades of study by both sides as to how to best accomplish narratives and messaging.
So how do we, with there a smear industry being out there, how do we as individuals avoid being influenced by it?
I think mostly by asking questions. I like to say that there are thousands of news stories that are deserving of being reported on a given day. And when you turn on the news or look at your social media feed and you see the same two or three stories day after day, night after night, being reported in similar ways, with the same people being quoted and similar phraseology, you have to conclude that there's a possibility that narratives are being fed, that people are trying to persuade you. Doesn't mean everything you're hearing isn't true, but it may mean you're getting an untrue, partial, or exaggerated version of the facts. And you need to say to yourself, who is it who wants me to think this and why? And what perhaps are they trying to distract me from? Because as you'll see the smear artists confess in the book, oftentimes they throw a lot of information out there just to confuse so people can't focus on the thing that they don't really want them to look at.
So analysts that say most of this by the mainstream media's part is simply for ratings. That's why you see CNN constantly talking about Russia and Trump. Is that really what it's about?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm not saying there's not a component of that, but I argue that ideology and other motivations, corporate connections and connections to special interests at a higher level are often behind the behavior that sometimes, quite frankly, is counterintuitive to ratings. That's, I used to find that we would stop stories toward the end of CBS that were very popular and that I had been told, you know, were ratings drivers in some respect, that they could tell people stay tuned to watch a particular type of story. Mm-hmm. When we stopped doing them, it didn't make sense to me other than there were influences outside the news division sometimes exerting pressure on the news division because these were things that in terms of ratings they should have wanted to do. So I don't think that can explain everything. And I think that when ideologically the thing that they're doing, that we're doing in the news is in line with what happens to generate ratings, then it's easy to point to ratings and justify it and pat yourself on the back and say, well, I'm doing what the people want. The fact is, you know, you could put naked weathermen, weather women on TV and your ratings would be the highest, but you don't do that every night because that's not what news is. There's decisions to be made about what to do and what constitutes news and what doesn't.
Right.
The reason certain decisions are made, I think, aren't fully to do with ratings.
Interesting. How much honor would you say is in journalism in the industry now?
It's a good question. I just got done judging the Emmys, which I do pretty much every year, and I saw almost every outlet putting out some really strong investigative reporting and just daily news reporting that you don't see all the time. You don't see as much as you used to, but there's plenty of it there.
Mm-hmm.
And there are plenty of reporters trying to do and report the right thing, but they're finding it harder and harder to break through in this media environment where the kind of reporting they want to do isn't rewarded. Mm-hmm. So I think there is honor to be found. I think people are trying to figure out how to operate honorably within the constraints that are given and within the changing business.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of players that have entered, we've invited into our newsroom who are not really journalists. They're either ideologically entrenched or they're political operatives who we've given jobs and put them in editorial positions in the newsrooms. And that certainly muddled everything.
Cheryl Atkinson, her brand new book is The Smear, How Shady Political Operatives and Fake News Control What You See, What You Think, and How You Vote. Cheryl Atkinson, right here on 1320 WILS. Cheryl, it's been wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
You too.